welcome everyone to tonight's webinar. It's on international trade law and border carbon adjustments, and we're lucky to have our own Dr. Ross Astoria with us. Before jumping into a quick bio, just let me review our three main points. At this point, if we've done our job well by the end of the hour, you will feel accomplished in reviewing the history and context for how international trade law is determined. You'll also feel accomplished in examining the Energy Innovation Act's border carbon adjustment design, as well as understanding the impact of how those adjustments then implicate larger global climate diplomacy outcomes. To do that tonight is our very own Dr. Ross Astoria. Dr. Astoria is a professor and chair of the Department of Politics, Philosophy, and Law at University of Wisconsin at Parkside. He served as CCL's board chairman for several years now and been a volunteer with CCL for many years before that. And he's also the director for CCL's Advanced Climate Policy Camp. I'll pass it to you, Ross, and then review our agenda and jump right in.
All right. So thank you, Brett. So here's what we're going to do here, our agenda. We'll look at the context of international trade and something called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. We'll look at a quick history of the trade treaties. We'll see what tariffs are and how disputes over tariffs are resolved by the World Trade Organization. We'll look at the actual design that the EICTA, the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Acts, uses for fossil fuels and carbon-intensive goods, and then the way EICTA is set up. Can I say EICTA, Brett? I keep saying EICTA.
I think let's stick with Energy Innovation Act just for the sake of those uninitiated.
All right, so the Energy Innovation Act gestures towards and tries to use the border carbon adjustment to get us towards some sort of climate diplomacy. Context of international trade. And so one question we get here is, who cares? Why is this important? And there are a number of reasons. The first is a lot of people in Congress care, so, and we're trying to influence those members of Congress. So every year we do our legislative director, Danny Richter, kind of takes our notes and he digests them and analyzes them. And the border and China in particular pop up pretty frequently. And so being able to give our members of Congress a particular and specific answer to how the border carbon adjustment works is important. And I can also tell you that we have quite a few allies and partners in both the NGO world and the business world who are interested in understanding how this works. And the question, what about China, keeps popping up over and over and over again. And the context for that is not so much do we trust China with respect to doing their mitigation commitments, but given the other trade dispute going on, will the international trade framework still be applicable to whatever border carbon adjustment arises with respect to China? So there's a lot of I guess they're contentious at the moment, trade diplomacy items that are popping up on a lot of people's radar screen because of the recent tariffs on China. All right, so we want, CCL is looking for a stable climate, simplicity in a policy that's simple and low cost, and fairness and transparency. So we, in the case of a border carbon adjustment, the best case scenario is it's not needed. And in particular, if our trade partners are engaging in effective or equivalent mitigation, then we don't need a border carbon adjustment. And in particular, if they have a price on carbon, the border carbon adjustment can be suspended. In a couple of slides, we'll look at how the Energy Innovation Act does that. In the next best case scenario, we want an accurate and low cost adjustment for every imported, exported carbon intensive good. And low cost in this means low administrative costs. So we want to make sure that both the trade partners are doing as little paperwork as needed and that the border agents who are administrating the BCA are doing as little paperwork as needed. All right, so how does a border carbon adjustment work? At the 10,000 foot level, a border carbon adjustment places a price on goods on goods imported from or exported to countries without an equivalent carbon price. The adjustment has two parts. So an equivalence fee on imports from countries without similar carbon price. So if the good is coming into the United States and it's not carrying any carbon price or Pigouvian pricing, as we call it, then the equivalence fee is placed upon the imported item. And we'll get into the details on how that works. And then a rebate on exports related to the carbon content of certain U.S. products exported to other countries. So it's symmetric in that if the good has an equivalence fee put on it on importation, then if you're a U.S. manufacturer and you export that like good, you receive a refund or a rebate of the carbon pricing that is kind of built into that product. All right, so a history of trade treaties. All right, so the United States is a member of what we call the WTO, the World Trade Organization. It's the only global international organization dealing with the rules of trade between nations. And a great number of countries in the world are parties to the WTO. And there's a nice little graphic that Brett put together. Thank you, Brett, on the right, illustrating who's in and who's out. And you can see almost everybody is in, and there's some observers negotiating accession, getting into the agreement. If you want to think about the kind of overarching goal of the WTO, it's to ensure that trade flows as smoothly and as predictably and freely as possible over borders. So the idea is to not allow political borders to interfere with commercial interactions. For a number of reasons. One, a lot of people think that tariffs and borders can be economically inefficient, but then there's the political consideration, which is that using the political border to interrupt trades of flow can have political ramifications in other countries. And I think we're seeing some of those political ramifications with respect to the tariffs between China and the United States. So the effort here with those agreements is to try to minimize those disruptions and aim towards some sort of economic efficiency. So the GATT, and I'm going to say GATT from here on out. That's the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, first agreed to by a small handful of countries in 1947. Originally, the GATT was supposed to be the kind of law for an organization called the International Trade Organization, ITO, which was to be one of the Bretton Woods institutions along with the World Bank Development, the World Development Bank and the IMF. The GATT was agreed to by a number of countries, mostly exclusively European countries at first. But the institution didn't arise to implement it until almost 50 years later. In the GATT is the rules for world trade. We good there? I'm getting some weird feedback.
Yeah, you're all good. Okay.
Sorry about that. It must have been my mic. And what happened with the GATT is between 1947 and 1994, there were a succession of trade negotiations in which the members to the GATT tried to get more countries into the GATT and to expand the kind of open up the trade barrier, reduce trade barriers more and more and more. And so by the 1980s, we had quite a large number of countries who were members to the GATT, and it needed a pretty thorough updating, and that was the Uruguay round of trade agreements, and that finished up in 1994 with the Marrakesh Agreement establishing the WTO in 1994. So I think the interesting thing about this story is the GATT has been with us quite a long time, almost 50 years before an institution arose in order to implement it. So at the same time that the GATT's kind of old, the WTO, which is interpreting that agreement, is pretty new and fresh. What is fewer than 25 years of litigation there. All right, so I want to talk about in this next round of slides, what is a tariff and how are disputes resolved? And all this leads up to how a border carbon adjustment would be implemented. And in particular, let's roll to the next slide. I want to, and this is important for having particular conversations that CCL members might have, is a border carbon adjustment is not a tariff, according to the legal distinction made by the GATT. Now, you can think of a tariff as a price paid in order for the right of accessing the country's market. So you pay that at the border when you import your good, and you can kind of think of that as allowing you into the country. A border carbon adjustment is going to turn out to be different than that. The way tariffs work under the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs is each country gets to submit what's called a harmonized tariff schedule. And the harmonized tariff schedule just lists, it's an incredibly long list of articles, and then it tells, kind of announces to the world what the fees, the tariffs are going to be on those articles when imported. So here I have just the U.S. harmonized tariff schedule from the first, this is just alphabetical order. So this is animals, live, something like that. And you can see on the left, there's a numerical heading and subheading and subheading. And then their article description, live horses, asses, mules, and hinies. And then unit of quantity, and in that column, unit of quantity here, they're not distinguishing the quantity of the different animals, but those units of quantity can be, will end up being the basic unit of trade. So it could be a ton, it could be a kilogram, whatever the basic unit of trade for that good is. And then in the rates and duty, the rates of duty on this sequence of right-hand columns, there's a one and a two. And what this is what's called a tariff binding. And so in the harmonized tariff schedule, each country is going to say, we are going to put a tariff of between this amount and that amount on the imported goods of this and that type. So under the general binding for asses on the left, it's 6.8%. And then on the right, the upper tariff binding is, I can't read that on my screen, but I think it's about 15%. And then in that middle column, the special is those are the countries with which we have a free trade agreement. And I don't know what country is A plus in there, but I want to figure it out. But you can see there's MX, which is Mexico, and CA, which is Canada. So that's probably the NAFTA or whatever we're calling this new trade agreement here. So what happens with a free trade agreement is we drop the tariffs, or nearly drop the tariffs, on imported and exported goods from that country. So one thing just to notice about the tariffs here is just how descriptively distinct they are. So let's go to the next slide. And what I have here is the slide for steel. Again, you have the subheadings and the subheadings, and then you have the article description. Here, the unit of quantity is in tons and kilograms, and then the tariff bindings. And I just want to point out how precisely the description distinguishes one type of steel from another. So pig iron in Spiegeleisen in pig, blocks or other primary forms, non-ally pig iron contain yada, yada, yada. So it's very, very specific. And I just want to point that out because with respect to administering a border carbon adjustment, people sometimes go, do we really know what's coming in? And we can go, yes, we do know, because our harmonized tariff schedules have us keeping track of everything to a very specific degree that's coming in and out. So when we start administering a border carbon adjustment, you wouldn't want to put this into the harmonized tariff schedule, but you can imagine this list of steel goods being the distinct types of goods which each have a different type of carbon content associated with them. So Article 1, Most Favored Nation principle, is Article 1. It means trade without discrimination, and make sure to treat other partners equally. The phrase most favored nation is, I think, entirely confusing. And if I were to go back to 1947 and make a recommendation, I would ask them to do a different phrasing here. But the general idea is however a particular country treats the most favored nation that it trades with, it has to treat all other countries the same way. So if the United States has a very low tariff rate on steel imported from Canada, say 2%, then that's the most favored nation treatment. And the United States then has to treat imported steel from other countries in the same way that is treating the steel imported from the most favored nation status. And the idea here is, again, discrimination. So the United States can't pick and trade how it's going to implement its tariffs with respect to this or that country. Article 3 is the national treatment. And this one is national treatment means an importing country has to treat imports the same way it treats like domestic products. But the idea here is if the United States has a tax on a certain steel product, it's a domestic tax, it's an excise tax, say, then it can tax the imports of that same like product from other countries, but not in a different way, right? So if there's an excise tax on steel in the United States of 5%, it can charge a 5% excise tax on steel imported from Canada, but not more than that. So you can see between Article 1 and 3 of the GATT, what the attempt to do here is to make it so that nations have to treat imported articles in the same way they treat domestic articles, and then they have to treat all imported articles from different countries in the same way. So it's trying to harmonize the regulatory and the tax regime and the tariff regime across the trading partnerships here. One article to be aware of here with respect to the GATT is Article 20, subsection B and G. And this is the general exceptions article. So one thing that could happen is you could design a border carbon adjustment and you could think really hard about how to make it compliant with Article 1 and 3, but you could mess it up. And if that happens, then you could rely upon the general exceptions B and G, which are the environmental exceptions. And you don't want to do this. There seems to be, amongst the folks I talk to, there seems to be a wide agreement that you don't want to have to use the general exceptions. But if we did, those general exceptions would be, so there's an exception for the protection of human, animal, plant life, or health. And then there's an exception for measures relating to the conservation of exhaustible natural resources. So you would need to put your argument into legal speak, but probably everyone on this teleconference could tell us why mitigating carbon dioxide emissions was necessary to protect human, animal life, or plant life, or health. And so your argument would just go, the border carbon adjustment and a carbon price are necessary to do those things. But again, you don't want to rely upon Article 20 unless something goes awry. So what happens when one country thinks another country is violating its treaty obligations? So this is a very simplified structure here, but a panel of the WTO can make a determination after the countries have consulted with one another, and the panels, I think, are usually three folks. And if the panel finds, and then there's a system for appealing and going back and forth between the panel and the appeal. But if a non-compliant country can change its measure, then it can do that. And if not, the other country can use what's called equivalent countervailing measures. So if the United States was violating its treaty obligations in the GATT with respect to, say, Europe, then Europe could use a countervailing measure on an article that the United States was importing into Europe. And something like this seems to be going on with the United States-China relationship right now. I was talking to my colleague down the hall who is a philosopher, so a smart guy, but was kind of astounded that China was able to slap countervailing duties on particular goods that were being exported and grown from particular regions of particular places in the United States. So I think cranberries, I think China put a countervailing measure on cranberries in response to the United States tariffs. And he was kind of astounded that China was able to pick out cranberries, which are grown in Wisconsin, as a way of trying to punish certain types of voters in the United States and get them to pressure their Republican members of Congress to pressure Trump to change their position here. But that's kind of baby play, picking out which products are grown where and who the members of Congress are that have that constituency, and then slapping a tariff on it. But you can do that under the equivalent countervailing measures. There's a key term in the national treatment discipline, which says that no taxation on an imported good should be in excess of the domestic tax. So this means, for our purposes of the border carbon adjustment, that there's two things you have to do. You can't do a border carbon adjustment unless you have a domestic carbon tax, right? And then you can adjust it. So you can't just adjust without a carbon tax. And then the second is, whatever the domestic tax carbon tax rate is, it's got to be the same rate on the imported goods. And what that means then is that the border carbon adjustment has to be levied upon the carbon footprint of the imported goods, right? It's carbon content. And it can't be levied on the good itself. So this means we have to keep track of, in some way, we have to do life cycle analyses of the imported goods that are subjected to the border carbon adjustment. And the Energy Innovation Act and most other border carbon adjustments, both those that exist and in the academic discourse, kind of distinguish between fossil fuels and carbon intensive goods. So let's see how fossil fuels are treated. So how would you calculate the carbon content of a fossil fuel? And this is an example of how California keeps track of the carbon content of fossil fuels. California has something called the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. And what that does is it requires that blenders in California kind of, they take petroleum from different regions in the country, and they mix them together. And originally this blending standard was to help with criteria pollutants, to make sure that you had petroleum of the right amount of nitrogen, not too much nitrogen, oxygen, and that sort of thing. But they've taken that structure and they've said, okay, blenders, your fuel has to have a certain carbon intensity. And carbon intensity for California in this regulation is grams of carbon per megajoule of energy. And the way that California calculates the carbon intensity of the fuels brought into California is by using the greenhouse gas regulated emissions and energy use in transportation, or the GREET model. It's put out by Argonne National Laboratory. And what that does is it tracks, as far as I can tell, every single fossil fuel, ethanol, all sorts of fuels from all sorts of places. And it tries to do a life cycle analysis of those fuels. And so the border carbon adjustment on fossil fuels would rely upon the GREET model, with perhaps some additions to it. And over here on the right, you have what I call the surface manifestation in California's regulations, which tells us the carbon intensity of these different imported, this is all crude oil. And so you have Angola, Brazil, and Canada here. And I love this list because the names of the different fossil fuels are just, I think they're very interesting. It's like looking at different wine blends. So Albion Vacuum Blend, Canadian Heavy, Fosterton, High Prairie Bitumen. But then you can see the different carbon intensities here in the Albion heavy synthetic, has a very high carbon intensity, 21 grams of carbon dioxide per megajoule. So you can make some inferences back and you can probably go, oh, that's the tar sand, right? And the synthetic gives you a little bit of a clue there too. So those have very high carbon intensity. So one cool thing you can make an inference about this is for California, they're using this for a low carbon fuel standard. But if you use the border carbon adjustment, and even if you use the same rate on the carbon for these different petroleums, which ones are going to get whacked out of the market first, right? The ones with the worst ratio of grams of carbon per megajoule, right? And that's kind of the result you want, right? You want the tar sands to the worst polluters to come off the market first under the carbon taxation. All right, so that's kind of the bare bones of how fossil fuels would be measured and then assessed at the border. All right, now carbon intensive products. This is a little bit more challenging. So what is a carbon intensive product? First of all, the Energy Innovation Act and again, most other border carbon adjustments that I've seen make a distinction between carbon intensive goods and non-carbon intensive goods. So what makes a good carbon intensive? And here, in defining carbon intensity, you want to keep the environmental goal of preventing leakage in mind. So the environmental purpose of the border carbon adjustment is to keep production from moving from the United States to another country where carbon intensity is worse. So that is the environmental objective. And you do that by saying a carbon intensive good is a good prone to leakage. And here you have two metrics. First is the ratio of the product's value in dollar value to its greenhouse gas emissions when they exceed a certain percentage. So I didn't put a percentage in there because I think there's going to be some pretty heavy discussion about what that ratio should be. And then the second metric to determine carbon intensity is the proportion of the product which is traded internationally. And that's usually around 15%. And so here's how the Energy Innovation Act identifies this. So it actually does two things. First, it gives the administrator a list, and that's iron, steel mill products, so on and so forth. And then the next thing that the Energy Innovation Act does is it says, okay, take this initial list, administrator of the border carbon adjustment, and refine it. Right, so find other products that might be emit carbon intensive. Oh, and if our initial list is wrong, remove those. So it gives us a baseline to start with. How extensive are the products that are carbon intensive? And the way this works is we work with the North American Industrial Classification System, or NICS codes. And I'm pretty sure the NICS codes arose in response to NAFTA. And NAFTA requires that in order to be a free trade agreement, basically all the products have to be tracked and kept track of which country they originate in. So I think this is a part of NAFTA administration. But 44 of about 500 U.S. industry groups are considered energy intensive and trade exposed, which is less than 10% of the NICS codes. These industries comprise 12% of total U.S. manufacturing output and less than 2% of GDP and employ 0.5% of U.S. workers. The U.S. industry's energy costs average about, across the United States, the industry's energy costs average about 2% of their product costs. So in general, energy cost is a fairly small fraction of production cost, and it takes quite a bit of work but it's a pretty energy intensive industry where that energy cost gets above 5 or 10%. And here's the list of 8 industry NICS codes that have 5% intensity or more. Nitrogen fertilizer is in there, and black carbon. This is a graph put together in 2009 by an interagency working group led by the EPA in response to the cap and trade bill. The cap and trade bill had a border carbon adjustment, which I did indeed separated out carbon intensive products for others. And here We don't have the names of these listed up because it's very hard to read them. But you can see here, if you on the horizontal, you have energy intensity, and on the vertical, you have trade intensity. So if you imagine those two metrics as forming a matrix, and then the line is the boundary between them, you can kind of get a sense of which products would be in the carbon intensive category, and the size of the bubble indicates how much emissions they have. So notice there are some products here that are carbon intensive, but they don't have a lot of emissions. All right, so just a reminder, I have a suspicion that a lot of people on this video conference are aware of this. I think this is a really cool map. It shows us the rather extensiveness of carbon pricing efforts across the globe. And I like this because a lot of times people go, oh my gosh, it's going to, a border carbon adjustment's going to really mess up this or that, or other countries aren't doing anything. In fact, I think just the opposite, and which is a lot of countries have mitigation commitments, and those mitigation commitments include carbon pricing. So I imagine that the United States putting up carbon pricing will enable other countries to also enhance their own carbon pricing. And I think if we do the border carbon adjustment right, then that can also be a way of reinforcing and supporting other countries' mitigation efforts. So a lot of times people will say, wait a minute, the border carbon adjustment, you're going to try to force people to price carbon or engage in mitigation. And that sounds skeptical or worrisome to them. And you're like, no, we don't have to force them too much because they're doing stuff already. We can encourage them though and help them out. Partnership. All right. So one part of the border carbon adjustment is results from this interesting case, US turtle. And in this case, the U.S. Under the Endangered Species Act had prohibited the importation of shrimp from certain countries that whose fishing fleet used the wrong type of technology, i.e. In harvesting shrimp, they were killing turtles, and the turtles were endangered. And they said, you can't, the United States says, you can't import the shrimp unless you use a certain type of turtle exclusion device. And the WTO, and I actually had a nice conversation with the fellow who wrote this case, but the WTO said, a country can use a border measure in order to achieve an environmental objective, i.e. it could use a border carbon adjustment, but it, when it does so, it has to negotiate with other countries in good faith, and it has to kind of accommodate other countries' compliance efforts and allow them to use the policies and technologies that they need or want to use in order to achieve the environmental objective. And so in the case of a border carbon adjustment, I think it's a pretty safe extension to go. This means that when we put up a border carbon adjustment, we have to look at all of a country's mitigation efforts and not just their pricing efforts. And then we need to engage in negotiations around suspending the adjustment, the border carbon adjustment, when that importing country has some sort of equivalent mitigation measures in place. And this is the part where I think if you set a border carbon adjustment up, it acts as a facilitator of international negotiations and can enhance mitigation across borders. And so I generally call this climate diplomacy. So you want your border carbon adjustment to facilitate climate diplomacy. So a border carbon adjustment can encourage trade partners to implement their own prices on carbon. As we mentioned, they're administratively complex. So this is part of the answer to an earlier question. And so the best result is probably to have these matters resolved by treaty, but not necessarily treaty. A treaty requires the affirmation by the Senate, but you could do this. You could set this up with an international agreement or a something of lesser status than a treaty. And the Energy Innovation Act allows the suspension of the BCA when the importing country has equivalent mitigation policies and allows suspension with an international agreement. And I think the next slide is the language from. All right, and so here's the language that the Energy Innovation Act tries to accomplish this with. Therefore, the Congress encourages the Secretary of State or the Secretary's designee to commence and complete negotiations with other nations with the goal of forming treaties, environmental agreements, accords, partnerships, or any other instrument that effectively reduces global greenhouse gas emissions to 10% of 2016 levels by 2050, and which respect the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. So notice how it's an encouragement here. So it's kind of acknowledging the separation of powers. So the Congress isn't demanding that the Secretary of State do this. And so one thing to note here, it's still important who's Secretary of State, even if you have a border carbon adjustment. There's a range of instruments by which the Secretary of State could suspend the border carbon adjustment. Gives a target of 10% emissions by 2050, and then it has the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. And so the effort here, it seems, is to have the border carbon adjustment mesh with and resonate with the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, on which this is an important principle motivating the UNFCC and the Paris Agreement. So resonates with and meshes with rather than conflicts with those other international efforts. Okay, so common but differentiated responsibilities. This is the phrase that basically allows countries to engage in, it's a principle that shows up across different treaties, but in the climate change context, it basically means countries who have greater capacity and greater wealth and who have perhaps done more pollution in the past have a greater responsibility to mitigate than other countries. All right, some ideas here with climate diplomacy. So how might this play out? Countries might negotiate a bilateral carbon pricing agreement and expand it to other countries. Multiple major emitters negotiate multilateral carbon pricing agreement, opening a club to for others to join. And so you might imagine that the NAFTA countries all got together and they said, all right, you know what? A part of our free trade agreement is going to include carbon pricing. So we're gonna figure out how to harmonize carbon pricing between Canada, which is developing a complicated federal system, the United States and Mexico. So your carbon club might then overlap with your free trade agreement. There's this, I think, kind of interesting idea floating around called a WTO climate waiver. So there's a part of the WTO that allows countries to agree to suspend or violate parts of the GATT. And so one thing United States could do when passing a carbon pricing bill and doing a border carbon adjustment is also go to the WTO and try to put together a coalition of WTO members who want to sign the climate waiver that says, okay, we can violate or we can make little violations of the trade agreement for the sake of the way I imagine the border carbon adjustment working is it. You have the carbon pricing and the border carbon adjustment allows for the United States to engage with countries and their nationally determined contributions in order to ratchet up ambition. So the policy we don't know about the border carbon adjustment fully entails until a law is passed. So one feature of this is it allows the Energy Innovation Act allows for some of the details to be implemented by administration. And there's a reason for this. And that reason is if you get the statute wrong and it goes to the WTO and they say your statute is not compliant with the trade agreement, in order to fix it, what do you got to do? You got to get a separate bill through Congress. But if you your statute says, okay, administrative agency, implement the border carbon adjustment and make sure that you are compliant with international trade law, then if the administrative agency gets it wrong and the WTO says, ah, your border carbon adjustment isn't compliant, then what has to happen? Well, you don't need Congress. The administration can go back and fix it on its own. So that's part of the reason that we don't know all of the details. It's left up to the Treasury and the EPA. And CCL's purpose is to generate political will and empower citizens not to be a think tank. So there's some things that we are we're sketching out and we've thought through. And then other things we're going to have to say, all right, this is for the administrative folks. Two reports you might want to look at here. This one on the left is the interagency report, and it's got the methodology in it and a description of that graph I used earlier. And then this nice report from Aaron Cosby and some of his buddies at Entwine, which goes through how a life cycle analysis might be meshed with the border carbon adjustment. All right, so carbon intensive goods and fossil fuels entering the country are eligible for a carbon border adjustment. A properly constructed adjustment is compliant with the MFN discipline and the national treatment discipline, and this diplomacy will be required to integrate mitigation regimes between countries and borders.
Things, one of which is, again, remind people on the line, if you haven't yet attended CCL's policy camp, it's coming up this June 5th through the 7th in Washington, D.C. We'd love to have you there. Ross, as the lead instructor, has put together a wonderful crew, including the wonderful Dr. Barry Rabe and many other well-known professors. They'll be there for several days. It's where all the wonks are hanging out. If you want to join us, we'd love to see you. Where to find upcoming training? We are on a new community platform, as you know, and to find upcoming trainings, you can always go to the website of New Community, that's community.citizensclimate.org, and then in the training topics page, there's an upcoming training session. At this point, if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out and email me after tonight. I'll steer you towards the right person. And we'd also love to steer you towards the Energy Innovation Act Forum. At this point, it's a robust discussion, and Ross and many others are weighing in there. So anything that you'd like to clarify further, we'd love to point you there. It's an honor to have all of you on the line. Thank you for your time, your leadership, and your involvement. We look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you again for being here tonight.
Thank you. Good night, Brett.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Go team.